Okay, everybody ready? I was going to give a little bit of the history about how the Christadelphian doctrine got started in New Mexico. And as I give this, I'll go into detail a lot and then probably ask for some questions too if you have any questions. So the way it started, there were three families down in Texas, down about where the Texas Bible School is now, in what they call Blanco County. In Spanish, it's Blanco County. That's where it's got its name. The Poses, the Walkers, and the Campbells. And they had all been raised up in the Christadelphian doctrine down there. And I don't know how the Poses and the Campbells came into it, but I do know how my granddad, John Walker, came into it. He was raised a strict Baptist, and his mother died when he was young. And after he got up and married, he was working on the road. And the way the deal was in those days, if you either had to pay county taxes or you had to spend so many days working on the road. So he didn't have the money to pay the taxes with, so he was working on the road. And there was an old brother whose name was Haley, and he'd lost his right arm when he was a young man. I think it was during the Civil War. And he was a Christadelphian, and my granddad's folks were Baptists. So they were eating their lunch on the bank of the road there one day, and this brother Haley told my granddad, said, "John, did you know that God made some promises to man that he never did fulfill?" And he said, "No, I didn't." Said, "I'll tell you something." Said, "God has done everything he ever said he would do." And he said, "Well, yeah, that's right to a point, but," said, he has made some promises that have not yet been fulfilled." And he told him about the promises made to Abraham, and he said, "You go to home and read your Bible, and then you look over in Galatians in the 3rd chapter, and you'll see what I'm talking about." And after that, my granddad was baptized into the Christadelphian doctrine. So, back again to how this truth started. Their cattle down in that country then was, they said the country was pretty well overstocked. And they didn't have a lot of grass for their cattle, and it was free open range except for the private land where people had homesteaded and had private land. So they had heard about how good the country was up in the Oregon Territory, and they thought they'd just round up their herds, Texas Longhorns, and all pull together and head for Oregon. So the way the story goes, the Walkers and the Poses, they all had their cattle together, and then there was a younger brother, Brother Joe Campbell, and he'd been going with one of the Haley girls. And Grandpa Haley, they called him, the fellow that had one arm, was real strict with his daughters. And this girl, I don't know how old they were, but they were both pretty young, so they were really wanting to get married. So they asked the Walkers and the Poses if they could just elope and go with them. And they didn't know the details about it, but they said, "Sure, come on." So that night she crawled out the window, and the next morning they headed out. After a little while, my Grandpa Haley said, "Where's Haley?" He said, "Well, don't know." And he got to inquiring around and found out that she had left. He said, "Well, I'm going to go catch them and bring her back." So after a couple of days, he caught up with them, and after he looked the situation over, he got on his horse and rode back. So after that, one of his other daughters, Josie, married another Bill Campbell after they got into New Mexico. But they started out in the late summer there from Texas, and they were going to try to get up into Oregon before it got too cold a weather. And you can imagine the planning that it would take to make a trip like that. They had 11 small children. I think the oldest one was about 10 or 12, and the rest of them were, I know a couple of them were still nursing. So they said, first off, we need to have some ground rules. So said, well, we'll plan to have our breaking of bread every Sunday, regardless of the weather or whatever. We'll stop, have our breaking of bread. They said also that the children that were with them said, if any of the adults want to correct any of the children in whatever measure they see fit, that's the ground rules. Go ahead and do it. So they also decided that they would pray that they never would have to bury one of them on the way. So they rounded up their cattle, and as they headed north, while they finally came to the banks of the Pecos River, and before they got there, they would send scouts ahead. There wasn't any paved highways. They just two wagon ruts going along, and sometimes not even that. And they would inquire as they went along about how far they'd have to drive, maybe without water, or how far they would have to go without food where they could stop maybe and buy more provisions. So they'd send some of the men folks on ahead as scouts, and they'd sort of inquire and find out what the future held as far as travel was concerned. They finally found out that before they would get to the Pecos River, they would have to travel about 2 or 3 days. I don't remember how long it was, but it was quite a long travel without water for their cattle, but they would have to take barrels and things for their teams of horses and to camp on. So they were going along, things were going along pretty good. You can imagine about the covered wagons and with all those kids and hot weather and what the food would be like. So they found out that they'd have to travel that distance without water, so they were paralleling the Pecos River, and they found out that it was at flood stage, and they'd have to come to a place where they could get the cattle into it. When they got there, they'd be thirsty, and they didn't want to lose any of them, so they were paralleling the Pecos River back a mile or two from it. And as the herd moved along, about the second or third day before they got there, it come up a little cloud out of the west and a stiff west wind, and those cattle could smell that water from the Pecos River. And their nostrils were just dusty, and they'd stick up their old heads and their nostrils flaring out, and they would kind of move one to the other. And people don't know it, but cattle communicate. And they turned and they headed for the Pecos River. And the cowboys would ride ahead of them. They said when we'd get ahead of them, they'd just run around us like flies, and they just struck a long lope for the Pecos River. They said, well, nothing we can do. All we can do is follow them and see what happens. So they said when they got to the Pecos River, it was just as muddy as it could be, and it was really rolling. said those cows would just get up to a little bank there, not too high, probably about a foot or two. Said they'd just dive right off into that deep water. Said the last thing that would go out of sight would be their tail. They said, well, we'll lose every cow we've got, said that. And said, just so happened those cows had come up out there and said they'd just be slurping in that muddy water. And they all just floated down the river and swam around and climbed back out on the same side that they went in on. All but one old bull. And this one old bull went out on the other side. Well, they said, well, we could let him go. But Brother Posey said, I'm a good swimmer. Said, I can swim over there and get him. They called him Old Brownlow. He's a gentle old bull. And so my dad was 5 years old at that time, and he's told me this story. He said he remembered it well. Said, Brother Posey pulled off his boots and his shirt and said he got in that muddy water and said, I can remember how his back, his white back would shine as he was hitting the breaststroke out across the Pecos River there. And he went across, got around the old bull, jumped him back in the water and got him back on the same side. And they didn't lose a head. And he swam back across. Everything went good. So they went on up to about the place where they were going to try to cross the Pecos River. And one morning there was a fellow rode up there, a couple of fellows that had badges on. And they said that they were going to quarantine their cattle. Said they've got ticks on them. And said, if you go on north with it, you'll spread that disease on north, and we're going to quarantine you here till it comes a frost and kills them, and then you can move your cattle on. Well, that's a fake. The vets now have found out that don't work, but that was their theory anyway in those days. So they had to stay right there on that side of the Pecos River for 3 months. And some of the men folks said, well, we'll go back wherever we can find work and work around. And the women folks said, well, we'll stay here and kind of, they herd the cattle around and keep them all together and take care of the kids. And I think one of the older fellows decided he'd stay there with them and help around camp. So I remember my grandmother said that she would fish there in the Pecos River, and she caught a big old flathead catfish, and so big that she couldn't pull him out. So this other older fella come over there and helped her pull him out, and they had fish also for a day or two till it would spoil. So they stayed there, and my grandmother told some of the other ladies, said, we could build a little brush pen, or the Pecos River had a curve in it there. We could build a little brush pen around it here and put some of those calves in there of a night, and then the mother's udders would fill up full of milk, and the next morning we can catch them and milk them and have milk and also butter and cream. And my grandmother said she made a lot of butter, and she put it down in a little wooden keg. She'd render it up. Some of you young people don't know what rendering it is, but you just fry it. You just put the butter in till it melts, and then when it melts down, well, that's rendered. So they put it in this little wooden keg that's going to have that to go on for butter on their trip. So my dad said for a little while it tasted real good, but said after a little while, said that got to be the rankest stuff you ever smelled. Said everything they'd cook, they'd season it a little bit of that old keggy butter. He said, boy, the kids all hated it. But they stayed there till it frosted, and finally these officials came along and told them that they could go ahead and move their cattle on. So they came on up to what is called, I think they called it, the Horsehead Crossing in the Pecos River. And they crossed their cattle there and started on. And then the story goes that there was a fellow over in 16 Springs named John Hanson. And Brother Alan Purcell composed a song about this, Hanson and meeting the Walkers and all of that, and it's real good. You ought to hear it. Anyway, Mr. Hanson was he had already homesteaded there in 16 Springs, and he was a big man, and he'd lost his leg in the Civil War. And he said when he got shot right in the knee, and he said, I saw the joint water in my knee run out on the ground with the blood, and he said, I thought to myself, my knee will probably be stiff the rest of my life without the joint water in that joint in my leg. So he took blood poison in his leg, and they cut his leg off right above the knee, and then they didn't get it quite far enough, and it went on up, so they took his leg off right in the hip joint. And John Hanson would ride his horse with one leg, and he carried a crutch. And he'd tie it on the side of his saddle with a little light string, so if his horse fell or bucked him off, he could grab that crutch, and then he could walk with that crutch with his other leg. So he was down on the Pecos. He'd already homesteaded there, and he had a good-sized herd. And he saw our folks, and he told them, he said, if you start on to Oregon, said, you're in trouble. Said, weather's going to be bad. And said, right up there in 16 Springs, said, that's just as pretty a country as the Oregon Territory ever was. And said, if you'll bring your families up there, well, there's plenty of room for all of you, and we can hire a teacher and have school. So the men folks said, they talked it over with the ladies, and they said, let's go up there and look at it first. So they left camp and rode all the way about 100 miles and looked it all over, and they said, big ponderosa pines, and big high grama grass underneath, about that sometimes it'd drag your stirrups. So they went back and told the ladies, said, that's just paradise on earth. Said, we'll go up there and you can homestead 160 acres. And there's water there, springs there, and they call it 16 Springs. And before that, the ones that had settled there before that called it Pleasant Valley. But when they found out there were 16 springs in that drainage, in the 16 Springs drainage, they named it 16 Springs. And I knew an old Indian that the Indians had lived there first, and they put them on the reservation in 1872, I believe, and our folks left Texas in 1887. So this old Indian told me, said, the Indian called that the same thing as white man, said, the word is not lots of water, but lots of little springs, and the Indian word is Nagua Cenote. So I've remembered that Indian word about where we live. So they went back and told the ladies how good it was and decided that they'd come up there and homestead. But backtracking a little bit about John Hanson, when he homesteaded there about 3 years before that, there was a fellow there that was a real carpenter. He'd hew logs out with a broad axe, and I have an old log cabin right there on our place that he hewed out for Mr. Hanson. Part of it left. But Mr. Hanson made a deal with him. He said, that was in the spring of the year, and he said, what'll you charge to build me a two-room log cabin with a chimney in each end and a breezeway in between? And he said, I'll build it for $400. So he said, all right. He said, I want to move my family up this fall. And said, when I get there, I want that house to be built. And he said, all right. So they shook hands. They didn't sign a contract, but they shook hands. And Mr. Hansen, John Hansen, said that fall when he drove his cattle in there, when he got to where the house was supposed to be, he said, this fellow was hanging the last door. And all that I knew him by was Wildcat Thompson. And about 2 years ago, there was a fellow from down in Texas come up there, and he said, my great-granddad homesteaded in this country, and his name was Wilbur Thompson. I said, that don't ring any bells with me, but there was a fellow we called Wildcat Thompson that lived down there. He didn't have a wife, and he's kind of a rough character. Said, well, that's probably him. We got to checking, and sure enough, that was him. So that was his grandson. So he had built that house there for Mr. Hansen, and so he told our folks about it, and then when they came up there, they drove their cattle all the way, and I can imagine those cattle were in pretty hard living condition. Living down there on the Pecos there without much grass, imagine they were just pretty poor, we call it. So they got into 16 Springs. It hadn't snowed much yet, and said it was the 8th day of December in 1887. And when they came over into the canyon, they drove up a canyon that named Poison Spring. And that canyon got its name because of the water that was there. There was about 10 years before that time, there were two old guys coming in there looking for a place to stay. And they gathered some wild greens, and one of them ate it, and the other one didn't. And the one that ate it died, and the other one thought it was poison water. So I think what they got was probably some wild parsnip, and the root of that is deathly poison. So I guess there's an unmarked grave there somewhere. So they drove their cattle right up this poison spring and over to the top of the ridge. And right there on top of that ridge, they ate their lunch before they drove their cattle and their wagons off. No road or nothing, just had to go out through the boondocks. And I can still show you that old tree where they ate their lunch under it. It's on National Forest land, and they've logged it a couple of times, but for some reason they never did cut that tree. And the lightning struck it. It's dead in the top, but it's still standing there. And about 50 years ago, my grandmother told me, said, that tree looks now just like it did when we camped under it there, when we ate our lunch under it. And it is so steep going off into the head of the canyon there that they had to cut some trees and tie them on behind their wagons to keep the wagon from running onto the horses because the brake couldn't hold it. So when they came off into the head of the canyon, you folks that are going on the hike tomorrow, as you go by that old log cabin that's there, that's where Brother Posey homesteaded. They all said, we'll let you have the first choice. You've got the biggest family, so wherever you want to make your stay, well, that'll be it. So when he saw that, he said, well, there's water there and grass, and that's good enough for me. So he homesteaded that place and built that old cabin there. And I think that Thompson helped him to build it. So when you look at that house, and I forgot how many Posey children there was, but 8 or 10, they raised them there. Some of them were born there, and some of them were born after they came over here. And as you go up here where it says Cloud Country, and you see that big red barn across there, Brother Ed Posey's son Jack built that barn. So they left 16 Springs and came over here and had land over here then after that. But they went on down the canyon, and when they got right there, pretty close to where our cemetery is, my grandmother, she was kind of a leader in the ladies, like some of you ladies are. You know how it is. As some people will take the lead. And kind of, she said, well, if we homestead here, said, we'll have our cemetery right up there on that little hill. So sure enough, about 2 years after that, She had a little baby that lived about 2 months and died. So they made a little wooden box, went up there and had a little funeral service, buried that little baby there, dug a little grave and buried it there, and that was the first grave. And after that, then, there was a fellow there, buried there, whose name was Sam Perry, and he was a Civil War veteran, and he got what they called a pension from the Civil War, and that was like, you get money now, like from the military, like they give it. So he lived there with his mama, and they had homesteaded a place there, right up that canyon from where my sister lives now. And he had a bad drinking problem, he and his mama both. And every time they'd get there, he'd get his check, why, he'd go to town and order a keg of whiskey and bring it in, and they'd drink it till it was gone. So he went to town and bought a keg of whiskey, and he was coming home in his wagon, and he was coming right down that canyon. Why, I don't know what happened, nobody does, but he didn't come in, and they went to look for him, and he'd fallen out of his wagon, and his head hit a little stump right in the head of the wagon, and the wagon tire then had hit him right behind the ear, and the team was still standing there with the wagon kind of jackknifed. And I guess he got too drunk and fell out of his wagon, and he was dead. So after that, I never did know whatever happened to his mama. She left. But that's just history about the next grave that was placed there. And there's a white tombstone there about this high. You'll see it as you go by on the hike, and that's his grave marker. So right on down the canyon, my granddad homesteaded a place, and then Brother Joe Campbell homesteaded a place now right across the canyon from it. And it's about, nearly a half a mile across there. But a still day, they could get out there and holler and communicate with each other across the canyon there to tell each other the news or whatever. And right there in the mouth of that canyon where Brother Joe Campbell homesteaded, they call it Board Tree. And the reason they call it that was because when they'd build a house, they'd cut these big old ponderosa pine trees down, and then they would find a tree, they'd take a chip out of it, just cut in here and up here, and take a chip out about this big, and then they'd split it. And if it split real straight, they'd make shingles for the roof, and they'd say, oh, that's a board tree. So there's a bunch of those trees there, and that's where Board Tree got its name, and it's still called that. So that's what they would roof their houses with, was those boards that were made out of those boards that split out of those board trees. So they decided then that they would have a meeting every year, and it would last 3 days, and they'd just meet at somebody's house, and the ladies would all potluck it, and they'd bring their bedrolls and stake their horses out and hobble them. And you know, the Bible said then, just like it does now, said when you marry, you're supposed to marry in the Lord. So how are all these kids who are kinfolks going to find a mate in the Lord when it's like that? You're going to have to teach it to them, or maybe marry before you're baptized. So that was quite a problem. And I think Brother Posey's family, I believe they were all Christadelphian, if I'm not mistaken, except one. The Walkers, about half of them, and the Campbells, I think a little more than half of those were Christadelphians. So they would have their meeting. They didn't call it a Bible school. They just called it the summer's meeting. And then later on, there would be other people, and they'd teach the truth to, and there'd be quite a gathering. And some of the men folks would decide that they'd kill a beef for the meeting. And then the ladies would all cook it up, and then that's the way they'd have the food for the meeting. They'd sort of take turn about, my dad or his dad or Brother Joe Campbell or Brother Posey or whoever would kill a beef for the meeting. But before that, when our folks got there on the 8th of December, pretty good weather for the winter time, and right down in the mouth of what is called Walker Canyon now, that is named after my granddad, and they got up the next morning and said the snow was right up to the hubs of their wagons. And there they were without any shelter and with all those little kids, not much food. And there was a fellow that lived there. Then you'll see, as you drive over that way, you'll see an old gray house that's been rebuilt. A fellow lived there named Jake Snover. And he had been there several years, probably about 10 years before that. And they said, well, maybe we could go up there and maybe he'd come to a rescue some way. So they sent my granddad up there to talk to him. He told him what their problem was. And he said, well, he said, I'll tell you what, said, I'll take my mules down there and take your wagons across the canyon over there. Said, I've got a little house over there that's made out of sod. What sod is, when you plow up the grass and you turn it over, then it leaves a little strip like this, and stack one on top of the other like adobes or like bricks now or whatever. And they said, I've got a little house made out of sod, and it was also had a sod roof on it. And they had poles across there and sod on the roof for insulation, and said, I've got all my vegetables in there. But he said, I'll share my vegetables with you and take them up there and put them in my barn in the hay. They'll keep there and you all can move in that little sod house. So they said that looked real good to them. So they took their wagon. He took their wagons over there and they moved in there. And for 2 or 3 days, it was real cozy and snug as it could be. And then when the sun come out, and that snow went to melting, and that mud went to dripping through that ceiling down on things. Said that was the biggest mess you ever saw, so they moved out of the sod house and just lived in their covered wagons that first winter. And Mr. Snover told them, said, your cattle are sure poor. And then it got bitter cold, no telling how cold. And it got so cold that they lost nearly all of their cattle. Said some of those old cows would just stand out in the open canyons, and those old Texas longhorns, not used to the mountains, they didn't have sense enough to get up in the brakes and get out of that cold wind. And some of them froze to death in the snowdrift standing up. They lost nearly every cow they had. But Mr. Snover told them, said, if you'll split rails for me to build rail fences with, said, I'll let you work out a beef, and my cattle are fat, and you can just ride out on the range, and when you see one of my cows, well, you just go ahead and kill it, and I'll give you a penny a rail. They said, if you worked hard, you could split 100 rails a day. So they worked out a beef with Mr. Snover. And his brand was call that 7W. And on the old doorstep down there, that brand is still on, cut into the rock there, a 7W. So they went out on the range and they found a big fat cow and they said, boy, that's a good beef. And they drove it up under one of those old big pine trees and the big low limb on it, said, we'll shoot that beef and slaughter it there and we'll have meat. So they shot that cow, and they were dressing her out. Said, Jake Snover come riding up, and he looked at it, and he said, I'll declare, boys, you killed my milk cow. And he said, I told you that anything had my brand was okay, so no problem. So my dad said when they went to seasoning everything with that beef tallow and got rid of that keggy butter, that's the best tasting stuff he ever saw. And they'd boil that cabbage and season it with that beef tallow and boil that fresh beef and eat those steaks and said that was really living. So as time rocked along, they decided that they'd have a longer Bible school, or not a Bible school, just a summer's meeting. And they finally built a log schoolhouse there. And they didn't float a bond, they just all took their axes and teams down there. And they built a schoolhouse, and it's still standing there. You'll see it on the hike there just before you get to where the cookout is, an old log house on the left there. And that's, Mr. Hansen was the first teacher. You didn't have to have a degree, you just taught the three R's, and he knew them. So they had school there, and there was a family that lived across the hill in a canyon that they call Wet Burnt Canyon, and the reason they call it burnt is because a forest fire went through there. And the reason it's wet is because there's a spring in it, and the other canyon is dry burnt because there's no springs in it. There was some little kids lived down there, and it's about 7 miles and across a big, steep, high, rocky mountain, and there were lobo wolves in the country, bear, mountain lions. And there were two little twin boys and their teenage sister, and they'd walk barefooted from there up there. And they'd have school there 3 months in the summertime. That's a pretty tough way to get an education. But that's the way the story goes. And then later on then when they got New Mexico, well first, Otero was a county before New Mexico was a state. So the county furnished some money, and they built a schoolhouse there where we'll have the cookout there tomorrow. And that's where I went to school till I was in the fifth grade, and then they consolidated with Cloudcroft, and I went to Cloudcroft and finished high school up there. And that was during the war, and that's the end of my education as far as school was concerned. But my mother and dad boarded the fellow that built that schoolhouse, and that was in 1914. And that old house is leaning pretty good now, but it's still standing. It's kind of an old landmark. And the same thing, that old log house that's right across from where I live that Mr. Hansen built there is an eyesore, but it's kind of a landmark, and I hate to tear it down. So then they decided that they'd have church in the schoolhouse, or have meeting, they called it. And in those days, they called it church, too, because they didn't know those words were a heathen word, so they'd have their meeting in the schoolhouse, and that's where we'd meet every Sunday then when I was a kid to have our summer's church. So after that, when they consolidated with Cloudcroft, the brethren all got together and they said, asked the county what they would take for that, and they said, I think it was like maybe $200 or $300, I don't remember. But anyway, we bought that. My dad donated the land for it, and then they bought the building back, so it belonged to the Christadelphians. So then we'd have the summer's meeting there, and everybody'd have their automobiles, or a few of them. And right up here on James Canyon, there was a little schoolhouse there, too. And in the summertime, we'd have what we called all-day meeting. 1 month, we'd come from 16 Springs over here and meet. And the next month, then, they'd come over there and we'd meet over there and have all-day meeting. But the summer's meetings, then, were always over there in that part. And then after the automobiles got started, before they graveled the roads much, why, the roads would get real bad going into 16 Springs, and they decided that if they'd have, Brother L.E. Parker was the one that first went to calling it a Bible school, and he got that from Arkansas. Said, let's have what we call a Bible school and have it longer, maybe 4 days. So they said, okay. So Brother Will Parker then said, I'll donate the land here. So he donated part of this land, like I told you the other night, and then we bought part of it later on. But anyway, said, I'll donate this part of the land where this is, and we'll have a Bible school over here. So, and I don't know when it started over here. I believe it was about 1956 or 7. Some of them say it was later than that. Maybe someone can come up with a picture or something that'll show us when exactly when it was started. You have a question? All right, that's history. So when they started having it over here then, they didn't have a cookhouse. The women would still potluck it. But then Brother Wilson Brazil and a Brother Walter Lind decided they'd build this chapel here and also the kitchen there, part of it and part of this. So they built it and we'd have it here. And as the truth grew, and as the ecclesia all got together, I think we have close to 50 members now. And we meet over in La Luce in the wintertime and up here in the summertime. Rule of thumb, we come up here on Memorial Day, and we start down there on Labor Day. So the weather gets bad up coming up and down the hill to have it here all the time. And also these water pipes here are not winterized, so it's better over there in the winter and up here in the summertime. So open it up for questions. Anyone? Yeah.
Tell us a biscuit story.
Well, there was a couple that lived there in that log house that you'll go by there on the hike that finally, we got a chance to buy that property, but before that, there was a man and a woman lived there, and back during the Depression, money was hard to get. You couldn't find a job, and if you did, the people didn't have money to pay you, and people just worked for their board if they could find work. Sometimes they'd give people like 50 cents or a dollar a day. But this fellow had a job with the El Paso Times newspaper, what they call set and print. He was good at it, and he made $10 a day, and that was big, big money in those days. But he's a little short guy, and his name was Bill Gibbs. And his wife was about 6 feet tall, with coal black hair and bangs, and she was about part Indian. And the story goes she killed her first husband. I don't know why, but she was had a drinking problem too, pretty bad. So sometimes they would get to drinking, and when they'd get to drinking, they'd do things that people are not supposed to do. So he had a bunch of hounds, and he liked to trap. She had to cook bread and feed those hounds, and one day she got ginned up a little bit. She decided, I don't want to do that anymore, and she had a pistol. She baked a pan of biscuits, and she'd just walk outside, fetch an old hound a biscuit, and as he'd grab it, she'd just laugh and pop him with her pistol. Bill heard her shooting, and he'd come running down to the house, and he'd come running in there, and dead hounds laying around there, and he saw her there, happy as she could be, and he said, what in the world are you doing? And she said, I'm feeding these hounds biscuits. She picked an old hound a biscuit, and he grabbed it, and she just popped him. Bill run up and said, you stop killing my hounds. And she said, Bill, you want a biscuit? Later on, they left one time and they had a fellow staying there taking care of their things. And when they came in, why, they had a gun. And they were both pretty drunk. And they was kind of threatening each other. And this old guy decided, I better hide that gun. So he run in there and got that gun and hid it. And about that time, she decided, I better go get that gun. He's liable to get a hold of it, and no telling what. And she went in there, and the gun is gone, and she thought he had it. So she run off and come down to our house. And told my mother, said, Bill's drinking, and he's after me. Said, could I stay all night? And she said, sure, come on in. So mother put her to bed, and directly Bill missed her, and he thought, my goodness, she might have that gun. And he went in there and looked around, and it is gone, and she is gone. So he ran off and come down to our house and said, May's drinking, and she's after me. He said, could I stay all night? So we put him to bed in the other room. Next morning, mother fixed breakfast for him. Dad took him back home. But sometimes when he was gone, that lady was just as good to me. A lot of times I'd go up there and stay with her. And she was just as good to me as my mama was. I was a kid about 10 or 12 years old. And just as kind and good, and I never did see them when they was drunk. So mother always had a lot of, she was just as good, as kind as she could be when she wasn't drinking. But when she'd get drunk, well, she's pretty rank. They went to Cloudcroft one time to a dance. And there's an old guy up there that was the law, and he decided he'd put her in jail. So he grabbed her, and they had a little old jail down there under the hill there, and it was made out of just 2x6s, one on top of the other, and put her in there all night and said she liked to froze. The next Saturday night, she went to town and had on a pair of bibbed overalls. So she got to drinking, and lawman come up there. He's a pretty tough guy, too. And he said, I'm going to take you down there in that jail and cool you off a little. He grabbed her by the collar and started out the door. And she just reached in and bibbed overalls and pulled out a monkey wrench and hit him right between the ears and got in her car and went home. Any more questions, anyone? Oh, I've got a lot of Indian stories. If you're getting tired and want to leave, well, go ahead. There was an old Indian. Our folks knew the Indians well. And the Indians, like I said, had lived over there. And sometimes they'd come back over there and get some of their stuff and take it back across the ridge to the Indian reservation. And our ranch joins the Indian reservation 8 miles east and west. We're right south of it. So knew lots of Indians, and there's one old Indian. He's a little guy, and he couldn't talk much English, but he'd talk a little bit and make signs, and he said, I think I'm the same age as John Walker. And my granddad said, he looked like he's about my age, all right, but when he was a kid, he got bucked off of a horse, and it broke his neck. And his neck was stiff and leaned over to one side, and they called him Crook Neck. Everybody, that is his name. His name was Carrizo, and that's where the end of the mountain gods is now. That's where that canyon got his name, was from Crook Neck. So his neck was like that, and the Indians had made a raid down in Texas, and they'd got a racehorse down there, a solid black horse with a bow in his neck, and they called him the Apache Kid, and he was a racehorse. And the Indians would match races with the white guys, and they'd gamble. And so they had a big picnic one time down here at this little place they call Elk. And there was a fellow there that from Kentucky. Anybody here from Kentucky? So that's from the bluegrass country where they had the Kentucky Derby. And he had an old long-legged sorrel horse that was a racehorse. And he said, I'm going to beat that Apache Kid this time. So they had a race down there. And They said that this old guy had hired a professional jockey to come in there, and people bet lots of money on it. The Indians bet about all they had on it. And the old jockey was out there warming that old sorrel horse up and loping him around, and didn't have no racetrack, just going to run him right up the bottom of a place they had staked out there about a quarter of a mile or a little more. And said, "Where's the Apache kid? Where's Crookneck?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "They'll be here." I said, "A little spot of brush up there on the hill." And said, "It's the 4th of July." And said, "Directly Crookneck come leading that little horse down off of the hill." And said, "Been kind of hard year that year, and he hadn't shed off yet. He still had his winter coat on." I said, "The Apache kid rode up there, and Crookneck got on him and had a little saddle and a little quirt with a little red ribbon tied in the end of it," and said he got on that horse and warmed him up a little bit. They got ready and they started. And here they come running up through there just neck and neck, and said directly the Apache kid just took the lead and was passing that old horse, and said about that time it come a whirlwind and the newspaper went tumbling out across the track and blew right up against that horse's leg. He downed his head and bucked Crookneck off, and they lost the race. So another thing about Crookneck, one time the Indians, every Tuesday there at Mescalera, they had what they called, they'd give the Indians what they called rations. And the older Indians, or the ones that was crippled or something, would come in there and they'd kill a beef and give them, chunk it up and give them each one so much beef. So they'd caught a big old wild steer, and he was of sure rank, and he was sure on the fight, and had a good trail there, and said all these young Indian braves are setting up on the fence around there, and they'd stick their foot down, and that old steer would run up there and hook at their feet, and said, "Crookneck," said, "I'll tell you how us old timers kill a beef." And he had the big old muzzle-loading rifle. He said he loaded that old rifle up, and said he waited till that old steer was across the trail over there, and he jumped down off the fence and ran out in the middle and said, "Whoo!" Dropped down on one knee and said that old steer saw him and said, "Here he come." And he got about as close as you are there, said he, raised that old musket up and touched her off, and the smoke just flew, and that round ball hit that old steer right there and bounced off his head. He hooked Crookneck. Knocked him end over end over end. Them young Indian braves said, "Crookneck sleep long time." Yeah?
I'm kind of curious if you said that you were just from three main families.
Yeah? Well, I could write a book and tell you, but it'd take a long time. Some of them taught their mates the truth. And my dad's sister married one of the Hansen boys, and he never did come into the truth, but she did. And John Hansen, my granddad tried to teach him the truth, but he didn't want to hear it. But my granddad was always really preaching to people. And he was preaching to John Hansen one time, telling him about the Bible. And John Hansen said, "Sift your meal and save the bran. The next big meeting I'll join the band." So my granddad quit him. He said, no chance of teaching him, so he let him go. Yeah.
Two questions. Why are they called Mescalero Apache? Was that some kind of drug they used, or something they chewed, or, you know, like some of the Indians have peyote, I think it is, they chew, and it's gives them a high or something. I don't know. But why are they called Mescalero? You know that?
Well, there's a plant that grows here, and they call it mezcal, and the Spanish word for that is mescalero. So they would take that, and it looks like a century plant, and then right down in the middle of it, about big as a head of cabbage. They'd take that and chop it up, make mescal pits and put it in a pit and cook it like cabbage. And it was really a good, good food.
The second question is, were any of those Indians hostile when the pioneers came out here?
Not with our folks much, but they would sure steal. They had to steal. They put them on the reservation and expected them to make a living there on the reservation. And they'd been used to having everything. And they couldn't make a living. And they'd steal your cattle bad. But then when you'd see them, then they'd be your friend. But hunger will break through a stone wall, but they'd sure steal your cattle.
How much further west were Chiricahua Apaches?
There's several Chiricahua Apaches, and I can't remember the name of the others, but they were all Apaches. And you've heard of Geronimo, probably. But he wasn't an Apache. He was some other tribe, but he joined in with the Apaches right there in the last fights that they had. And Brother Will Parker, I'll tell you another story that he told me. He used to work for the cattle outfits, and the moneyed people in the east saw all this open range out here in the west, and they had lots of money, and they'd buy those Mexican cattle and bring them in here by the thousands. And then they'd hire what they called a wagon, and the wagon boss and the cowboys, and they'd take care of all those company cattle. Some of them was, one brand was the CA Bars, the Hatchets, and I don't remember a lot of the other old brands, but Brother Will Parker was working for one of them. And there was a fellow that was working for him that didn't come in one night. So they went to hunt for him. And they knew about the area that he was going to be in. And they found his horse, and his horse had got loose, and he'd hung his bridle reins on a little limb there, and he was just standing there, but no cowboy. And Will wrote a book, and that cowboy's name is in the book, and even the horse's name. And that cowboy found some of the company cattle, and he found where an Indian was trailing them, and he trailed along till he rode up on this Indian. And this Indian had a beef shot there, and he was fixing to slaughter it out. And when this cowboy rode up on him, he shot him and killed him. And when he saw what he'd done, he knew he was in trouble, so he run off and left, and he got his wife, and he decided he'd go to Mexico to escape being tried for it. So he got on a little old Indian pony, he and his wife both, and right over east of Alamogordo, right around the foothills there, they started for Mexico. And they rode that little old horse a long way, but the way they figured it all out, after they found that, and found the cowboy dead, they knew he'd been murdered. So they told the Indians about it, and the Indians said, "Well, that's no good. Said, we'll help you trail him up, and we'll get him." So those Indians could really trail. They could really read sign. So they got on his trail, and they trailed him around, and his wife didn't want to go with him. And she knew that they'd be trying to trail him up. And she had on an old skirt, and every once in a while she'd tear off a little piece of that skirt and throw it down. And they'd find that as they went along. And finally, that little old pony got so tender-footed he couldn't travel anymore. So he got pretty lame, and they run out of food. So they killed him and ate some of the meat and made some moccasins out of his hide and started on. And then they finally got up in some cliffs there. And when the posse come in, trailing them after them, this old Indian saw them coming. And he opened fire on them. And when they did, they opened fire on him. And the squaw got down there behind some big rocks. They killed him. And I knew the Indian well that killed him. And even saw the gun he killed him with. And then this Indian that got killed told me another Indian was telling me the story about it, said the reason he killed that cowboy, said he was deaf. He said he didn't hear that cowboy coming, or he'd run off. He said when he looked up and saw him, said he was just afraid, and he just threw up and shot him because he was nervous, and said he was sorry he did it, but said that's his side of the story. Yeah?
You were mentioning the cattle country. Did they have troubles around here like they did the Lincoln County Riders?
Not near that serious. I had an uncle that said he saw Billy the Kid one time, but that was, he just saw him. And he told a story about that Billy the Kid's buried there in Fort Sumner. And my uncle said that they were taking some cattle to the railroad out east of here. And out east of Roswell there, where they had about 1,000 head, and said they were camped there, and it come a big, big rain that night. And said before it rained, they're sitting around the campfire there, and they's all just talking, the cowboys. One cowboy said, "I knew Billy the Kid real well," and said, "he's one of my best friends." And said, "if I had one request to make, I'd say I wanted to be buried by Billy the Kid when I die." And they got up the next morning, it had rained and it was a flooding, and they got on their horses and started out to try to find their cattle that had all spread out from the storm. And there's a big gully there that was flooded, and our granddad couldn't swim, but he said, we started to cross that, and said, boy, out in the middle of that, then it is deep, and said, directly that horse just went under, and that cowboy was on him that said that. And said he went out of sight, and said they went around about a mile down there. The horse got out, but the cowboy, they found him down there, washed up in some brush, and he is dead. So the boss said, you heard his last request, said, who wants to take him to Fort Sumner and bury him? So the couple of guys said, we'll take him. So I guess he's buried there by Billy the Kid. Yeah? That means there's no fences. Cattle are liable to be on the highway. Back in the early days, it was all open range. You could homestead, and if you homesteaded, you could fence it if you wanted to. You didn't have to. But when they went to building fences then, well, that's when people went to heaven saying, this was mine. And then finally, the Congress of the United States told the people back east, if you'll come west and fight the Indians and the outlaws and bring your families, you'll have prior right to graze your cattle. So the open range was all run by what they called public domain. And you could just camp there or have however many cattle you wanted or whatever. And it was all open. So when people would homestead a place, they'd say, this part here is mine. And I've got the water all here, so I control this land outside of my homestead here, and I want to have this for my grazing allotment. So about 1906, the government decided that they would have a Department of Agriculture. So they had a U.S. Forest Service. And this Lincoln National Forest right here was one of the first forests that was named. And they said, we're going to charge a fee now for the cattle that graze on it. The homesteaders said, well, we've always grazed it for nothing. And they told us if we came out west here and settled, we could have our cattle. So they said, we claim this part here as ours. And that's where I've got a grazing allotment on our ranch, and it's government land. We own private land as well, deeded land. It's ours. We can do whatever with it. But the land that's around it then, because we control the water, then they've said if you control the water, you control the feed. So you own the feed too. So we called it what? Called individual grazing allotments. And it's public land on the U.S. Forest Service. It's operated out of the Department of Agriculture. And then on down in the lower elevations and some of the higher elevations as well in Colorado, it's operated by the Bureau of Land Management, and it's operated out of the Department of the Interior. And I have a grazing allotment on that as well. And it's for the winter, but the other one, the one up here, is for the summer. So we have two individual grazing allotments that we own, the forage and the water. Nobody owns any water in New Mexico. The state owns it all. But you have what they call water rights, and you have to declare this water has put to prior beneficial use by ours is for domestic and livestock, and some of them for irrigation as well. Well, that's the way the land was all settled up. And the open range that you see now is a lot of big ranches, much larger than mine, and most of it is on BLM and Forest Service land for these grazing allotments. A lot of it up in northern New Mexico is land grants, and that's public land. That's private land. They granted them like maybe a 500,000 acres, and it's theirs. Spanish land grants. Yeah?
Where did the saying after the Civil War come out, 20 acres and a mule?
Is what?
20 acres and a mule to get people out of the homestead. What state or states started that homesteading? Where they promised you 20 acres and a mule.
It'd be 160 acres you could homestead. And then down in the desert, they call that desert land entry. You could homestead a section down there. That's 640 acres. Yeah?
Somebody told me once the elk were brought out here for the Indians on the reservation, and they've expanded like they have. Or
the elk, there were a few elk here when our folks got here. Not many, just a few. And they were an elk they call Merriam's elk, and they're extinct now. There's not any more of those around. They killed them all out, or they died out, or something. My dad found a few antlers of that species, and then all of my life there never was any elk here till 1967. The Mescalero Indians decided they'd bring some elk in here from Yellowstone, and they brought in about 160 head and turned them loose on the Indian reservation. So that's where the elk all come from that are here now. They didn't hunt them for several years, and then finally when they went to hunting them, it seemed like they really did scatter out lots of elk now. The Indians, well, you can't count them. They do what they call pellet counts, the droppings that they leave. They'll come and say, okay, you've got 100 cows here, and we'll pick out this spot, what we call a key forage area, and see how many cow droppings there is here. Well, okay, in this spot, about 100 yards long, we find 50 cow droppings. Okay, we find 50 elk droppings. So that's a sign that there's 100 elk here in your allotment as well. So then, in the wintertime when the snow's on, they fly it with a helicopter and try to count them. And they can count part of them, but not, they say that our count is not near accurate. But the Indians claim they've got about 4,000 elk, and I think on this side of the fence, there's that many or more. Yeah?
Charlie, you said whenever your families came in, how did they come in from the Pecos? Did they come in like he was Artesian now at James Canyon, or is there another way?
They came up pretty well, like the highway comes. Okay. I think that they were south of the Peñasco River, more over toward Weed. They came through there and around, and they didn't come up this canyon. They come up Elk Canyon down here on the Indian Reservation. It was a wider canyon than this one, and they came up it, and then Poison Spring runs into Elk Canyon. They came up it and over the ridge into 16 Springs. Dismissed.